From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Social Security. With billions at stake, Wall Street is quietly lobbying to privatize it. Both parties are listening. We'll have a debate. The affirmative action controversy is blazing in California over Proposition 209.
Quotas do not exist anywhere in the state of California. The Supreme Court has already made sure that they're eliminated. One of the things that upsets me most about the campaign over Prop 209 is the commercials by the supporters of Prop 209 who say this is necessary to eliminate quotas. Quotas already are eliminated. This is just deceptiveness on their part.
And peddling arms, peddling influence. A new report exposes how much PAC money from weapons dealers is going to the campaigns. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton is spending more than $1 million a day on television ads in the campaign's final week as he tries to block any path to a Bob Dole comeback and put several traditional GOP strongholds in the Democratic column. With the luxury of a lead, Clinton has a campaign schedule that reaches through the final weekend and includes stops today in Michigan, Colorado, and Arizona. He won't be back in the nation's capital until after the election. Dole is campaigning in Tennessee, Louisiana, and Florida, and scrambling to settle on a schedule beyond that. Giving in to heavy pressure, the Democratic National Committee distributed a makeshift finance report listing $10 million in contributions and showing nearly $11 million in cash on hand at mid-month. Allegations that foreign money might have been illegally channeled to the party have put the DNC's fundraising practices in the spotlight. The heat increased when the party said earlier this week that it didn't plan to file its financial report to meet the pre-election day deadline. In his first public statement since being caught up in a furor over foreign-linked political donations, Democratic Party fundraiser John Huang says he took pains as a Commerce Department official to avoid any dealings with his former Indonesian employers. Huang, testifying yesterday in a civil suit against the department, also said he met quite a few times with President Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton at the White House. Before joining the Commerce Department, Huang headed the U.S. affiliate of the Lippo Group, an Indonesian conglomerate. The flap over campaign money erupted recently when news reports surfaced of hundreds of thousands of dollars in contributions to Clinton and the Democrats from a network of people and companies related to Lippo and its owners, the Riotti family. Newly released documents show that shortly after joining the Commerce Department, Huang attended two meetings in July and August 1994, at which officials from several federal agencies discussed strengthening trade relations with Indonesia. This despite its horrendous human rights and labor record. While Huang says he took pains to avoid any conflict of interest, he couldn't have felt quite as much pain as workers in Indonesia do. Among the most notorious U.S. corporate enterprises in Indonesia is Nike Shoes. You may remember a couple months ago, Nike chair Phil Knight standing in the Rose Garden with President Clinton. Well, Michael Moore is on tonight. Moore is the one who filmed the scathing documentary of former GM chair Roger Smith called Roger and Me. Well, he was just in Portland, Oregon, promoting his new book, Downsize This, in which he lists Knight as number three on his corporate criminal file. Moore was appearing on a radio talk show last Friday when Nike officials called and asked him to visit the company's corporate headquarters. Moore arrived in Knight's executive sanctuary, video crew in tow, and proposed departing for Indonesia on Sunday. He even pulled out two airline tickets out of his pocket. Knight said maybe next year. Nike Town is opening in New York today, where there'll be a large protest, including the National Organization for Women, which has just passed an anti sweatshop resolution. And this news from California. Opponents of a campaign to dismantle affirmative action programs in California began running a television ad yesterday showing former Klan leader David Duke in a white robe in front of a burning cross. The ad was unveiled a day after Bob Dole delivered an impassioned defense of Proposition 209 and a week after the state GOP, bowing to legal threats, pulled a clip of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech from ads supporting the ballot measure. Three former presidents are urging California and Arizona voters to oppose ballot propositions to legalize marijuana for medical purposes. Republicans Gerald Ford and George Bush and Democrat Jimmy Carter say legalization could lead to increased drug use among young people. All three have signed a letter saying they categorically oppose Proposition 200 in Arizona and Proposition 215 in California. A woman from Sullivan County, Pennsylvania, was convicted yesterday of helping her stepson's girlfriend, who is 13, get an abortion. Rosemarie Hartford, a middle-aged mother of six, was charged with driving the girl to New York for an abortion in 1995 to evade Pennsylvania's strict abortion control law. She faces up to 7 years in prison. And finally, the Washington Post says Bill Clinton leaves a lot to be desired as president, but at least is a better choice than Republican challenger Bob Dole. The paper argued that Clinton dropped efforts to balance the budget, proposed a health care plan that was a monument to hubris and political miscalculation, signed a damaging welfare bill, and took too long to get a strong grip on foreign policy. But they said, you would think a record like this would provide an opening for an opposition party. It did, in fact, the paper said, but Mr. Dole and the Republicans were incapable of exploiting it. And you're listening to Democracy Now! In this election year, voters have told candidates that one of the main issues they're concerned about is the future of Social Security. But the candidates have not addressed the issue in great detail. Perhaps that's because both Democrats and Republicans support privatization. In the latest edition of Mother Jones magazine, journalist Robert Dreyfus reports that a stealth campaign is underway to privatize Social Security, and that this effort is receiving significant political support from Democrats. What would privatization mean for the Social Security system? Is it inevitable? Joining us for a debate on privatization are Robert Dreyfus of Mother Jones Magazine and Michael Tanner, director of the Project on Social Security Privatization at the Cato Institute here in Washington, D.C. Well, why don't we begin with Bob Dreyfus? Tell us a little about what you found, what this stealth campaign is all about.
Well, I'm not sure the stealth campaign, because most of it's happening fairly openly, but I think very few people are paying attention to the issue right now, in part because until the election is over, there are very few politicians that really want to grab a hold of this third rail. It's called the third rail of American politics because if you touch it, you die. And most of the politicians who have brought it up so far are ones that are either extremely safe or, in the case in the Senate, not even running this year.
Like Bob Kerry.
Bob Kerry, Alan Simpson, of course, who's retiring. There are other people who in the House who are facing a Social Security challenge from their opponents, but meanwhile are in pretty safe districts. Yet I think the support for privatization is a lot deeper than that, and I think it reaches all the way to the White House. I think there are people in the administration who are looking at it pretty carefully, and I wouldn't rule out having Bill Clinton appoint a commission next year that would come up with a conclusion in the direction of at least partial privatization along the lines, let's say, that the Kerry-Simpson bill in the Senate has proposed or something along those lines.
What does privatization mean, privatization of Social
basically
Security?
Basically, what we're talking about is a fairly fundamental transformation of the way Social Security works. It would take it from a program which is now essentially completely organized by the federal government, which collects revenues, taxes through your FICA line on your paycheck each week, and then pays out benefits to current retirees and accumulates a surplus, which has been going on for the last decade or more, to pay for the expected wave of baby boomers when the big retirement wave starts hitting sometime early in the next century. Under privatization, what would happen is that a portion of those funds would no longer go into the government's pocket, but would instead be put into private accounts that would have a person's name on it. In other words, you would now control those funds as opposed to paying into the government. And the advocates of privatization say that it would create a better return. People would make a higher return on private accounts, and it would also reduce the size of the government. One of the things, however, that is not as often talked about is that a lot of the people who are lobbying for this stand to benefit from it directly. There are a lot of mutual funds and insurance companies and others who are putting up some money to fund studies by academics and think tanks who are contributing to political campaigns and who are basically pushing the idea of privatization without necessarily mentioning that they're going to make a great deal of money if Social Security is privatized.
Before we talk about just who those corporations are, let's bring Michael Tanner into the discussion with the Cato Institute here in Washington, D.C. You think privatization is a good idea. Why?
Well, I think we have to face some inevitable facts. I mean, Social Security's done a wonderful job for 61 years now. I don't think anyone can deny that. But demographics are destiny, and the demographics in this country are changing, and we can no longer support the Social Security system that we had. You know, the trustees of the Social Security system itself just issued their latest report in July, and they reported that the Social Security system will be completely insolvent in 2029. That's down from 2030 last year, and in fact, it's the eighth time in the last 10 years that they've lowered that date at which it becomes insolvent. But the real crisis actually starts much earlier than 2029. As early as 2012, Social Security will begin to be deficit spending. It'll spend more in benefits than it's taking in revenue.
Why has this happened? Why the change?
Well, simple demographics. When Social Security started, there were a great many workers for every person who's receiving retirement benefits. But people are living longer now, and we have fewer children, so we have fewer people in the workforce to support them. And in 1950, we had 16 workers in the workforce for every person receiving retirement benefits. Today, there's only three. And after the turn of the century, there will be only two workers for every person receiving retirement benefits. And it's not just solvency that's the problem either. You know, we can keep the system solvent if you raise taxes enough or if you cut benefits enough, you can keep the system solvent. But you also have the problem that it's just becoming a bad deal. Someone who retired 10, 15 years ago on Social Security did pretty well. They got back everything they paid into the system, plus interest, and a couple of times over. But someone out there today who's listening to the show who's, say, 35 years old, when they retire, they're going to lose money on Social Security. They will receive a negative rate of return, less money than they paid into the system. It's also a system that's unfair to minorities. You know, a black man's life expectancy today is 65.8 years. He pays into the system his entire life and dies before he collects benefits. It transfers money essentially from the poor and minorities to wealthy white women.
Does the family get the Social Security benefits if the man dies?
There's a small survivor's benefits, but it's far less than they'd be able to receive through private life insurance, and it's certainly far less than they'd be able to receive if the money was accumulating in an individually owned account and then inherited.
What's wrong with that equation, Bob Dreyfus?
Well, there are a lot of things wrong. I think, number one, there's no crisis in Social Security funding. Mike mentions that you would have to raise taxes to put the system back into balance. You'd only have to raise taxes 1.1% on the employer and the employee to put the system into balance for 75 years, according to that same trustee's report. In other words, by a 1.1% raise in taxes, you could fix the problem until the year 2074 or whatever it is. Now, taxes are not the only way of fixing the problem. There are other changes you can make in terms of lowering benefits slightly. You can raise the retirement age a little bit. You can recalculate the way benefits are paid in terms of cost of living. There are a lot of small changes you can make that would lessen the need to raise taxes. So the problem that we're facing, you know, several decades from now can be fixed right away by a very small adjustment made today. In terms of the...
Michael, you're shaking your head.
Well, I'm saying that's the return of Rosie's scenario. That actually assumes a much higher rate of economic growth than we're likely to see. Economic growth has been declining steadily since the 1950s and 1960s. We're not likely to see an increase. What Bob's using is what's called the intermediate assumptions of the trustees. If you use the pessimistic assumptions, which assumes that we have something like a recession in the next few years, the reality is rather than a 2.2, he says 1.1, it's 1.1 on the employer, 1.1 on the employee, so it's really a 2.2% tax increase. The tax increase could be considerably higher. In fact, it could be as much as 5 or 6% that's required, and that does nothing to deal with the fact that that simply worsens the return that young people will receive.
Well, I mean, you can take pessimistic or optimistic assumptions and so forth, but the fact is we have a social commitment in this country behind Social Security, which means that we as a country for 60 years have agreed to support people when they reach age 65 with Social Security benefits. Now, if it happens that the economy turns down, that doesn't obviate the need to support people at the age 65. So maybe we do have to increase taxes. Maybe the economy will get better and we won't have to increase taxes at all. So there's no reason to make the kind of pessimistic assumptions that we're making. It could be quite the opposite. And so the fact that more people are retiring and they're living longer simply means that we owe to our parents and grandparents the need to support them as a country. Now, you know, we've got years and years to prepare for this. We've known it was coming for a long time. And yet the people who are supporting privatization, most notably Peter Peterson, who is a wealthy investment banker in New York, who's been a doomsayer on Social Security for many, many years. People like Peter Peterson are trying to create a doubt in the mind of people that Social Security is solvent, that it's going to be around. They're even saying that the trust fund, because it owns U.S. Treasury bonds, is somehow shaky. Even Mike Tanner has mentioned that you might as well put your money in a mattress, I think he said once. The fact is the Social Security Trust Fund is as good as gold. It has the full faith and credit of the whole United States government behind it.
And that's absolutely irrelevant. Look, the Social Security Trust Fund right now contains government bonds. Government bonds are simply an IOU. They're an obligation to tax someone someday in the future to make good on the benefits. Let's assume as a mind exercise that there were no bonds in the trust fund. What would happen in the year 2012? That's the year Social Security goes into deficit. If there were no bonds in the trust fund in the year 2012, Social Security would have to raise taxes to pay benefits. All right, the bonds are there. They're as good as gold. What happens in the year 2012? Social Security has to raise taxes in order to pay the bonds to pay the benefits. The fact that an IOU is good, it still makes it an IOU.
Well, I mean, we're talking semantics about accounting here. The fact is that the Social Security Trust Fund is building up a surplus. It was a compromise solution back in 1983 when it started to become apparent that people were living longer, that the economy wasn't doing as well as expected back then. They made some adjustments. They started building up a huge surplus. This year, I think it'll be about $60 or $70 billion that Social Security takes in more than it pays out. Some of the proponents for keeping the system as it is have suggested that those surpluses could be invested in the private sector rather than in treasury bonds. That's a choice of, you know, where you put your money, what kind of return you want to make, what kind of risk you're willing to take. But the treasury bonds are the most safe investment you can make. And if the Social Security Trust Fund didn't buy these bonds, someone else would buy them. And so they would have their money somewhere else. I fail to see any basis for saying that Social Security has a crisis.
I was interested in how you began your piece, The End of Social Security as We Know It. You talk about Democratic Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska being agitated, surrounded by lobbyists at a private strategy session on Social Security. He fumes, "I don't know what the president thinks, but I know it's going to take presidential leadership." And you say you might think Kerry, a prominent Democrat, would want a reelected President Clinton to go to the mat to protect Social Security, the crown jewel of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt New Deal. But in fact, Kerry's the chief sponsor of legislation that would begin to privatize Social Security, and he wants Clinton's support. Asked whether he's worried about progressive Democrats mobilizing to defend Social Security, Kerry bristles, "I'll kick the bleep out of any liberal who tries that." How is Bob Kerry mobilizing right now, and is there any force that is mobilizing against him? You talk about progressive Democrats.
Well, I don't know if Bob Kerry is mobilizing at this point. I think he had trouble getting any more than Alan Simpson to sign on to his bill in the Senate.
Chuck Robb.
There were a lot of – that's right. Chuck Robb did. That's three out of a hundred. And recently, The Nation magazine did a check of Democrats associated with the Democratic Leadership Council, which has come out for some version of privatization.
And DLC, which, of course, DLC, President Clinton is there.
Right.
Star.
And a lot of their candidates disagreed and ran away from the idea of privatization. Still, I think there is a lot of movement behind this, and the counter movement is difficult to find. The seniors groups, in particular the American Association of Retired Persons, or AARP, has, as far as I know, not done anything on this yet. They're supposedly making plans for a defend Social Security fight, but I haven't seen any evidence of it. They were still reeling from the fight over Medicare in the last 2 years. The labor movement, the AFL-CIO, has come out formally against privatization. Rich Trumka of the AFL-CIO said no to privatization, and apparently they're going to launch an educational effort through their members. But it's still early in the game. It's still early for all sides, and this hasn't become a big legislative agenda item yet.
We're going to come back to this discussion after our break. We're talking to Robert Dreyfus, who wrote a very interesting special series in Mother Jones called Up in Smoke, with billions at stake. Wall Street is quietly lobbying to privatize Social Security, and both parties and the president are listening. We're also joined by Michael Tanner, director of the Project on Social Security Privatization at the Cato Institute. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're talking about Social Security. Our guests, Bob Dreyfus of Mother Jones Magazine, Michael Tanner, director of the Project on Social Security Privatization at the Cato Institute here in Washington, D.C. Michael Tanner, you have a piece called Privatizing Social Security, A Big Boost for the Poor. Why in particular the poor?
Well, the poor are very poorly served by the current Social Security system, and because the poor rely so heavily on Social Security. Let's face it, if Social Security went under, probably Bob and I would both survive. The simple fact is that middle class and wealthy people in this country have other alternatives. They have 401k plans. They have private investments. But the poor rely disproportionately on Social Security. The poorest 20% of elderly get 81% of their income from Social Security. And Social Security provides a very low benefit for them despite the progressive nature of the system. If we can increase the amount that they get in retirement through private investment, which yields a much higher rate of return, they'll do better. Second, how much you get back from Social Security depends on how long you live. Someone who dies at 66 gets a lot less back from Social Security than someone who lives to be 99. And the poor die earlier in this country than the wealthy. So what you have is a system that transfers monies from the poor to the wealthy, from men to women, and from blacks to whites in this country. And I think that that's a very unfortunate system.
What's wrong with that, with what he's saying, as you shake your head, Bob Dreyfus?
Social Security is the most important anti-poverty program we have. Back in the 1960s, when the war on poverty was beginning to mobilize its troops, people were shocked to find that the poor in this country were not in the inner cities. They were not in the mountain shacks of Appalachia. They were the elderly. People over 65 were overwhelmingly poor then because they had no medical care. They had no access to decent retirement programs and insurance. So benefits for Social Security were increased starting, you know, at that point and really through the current time. Now, without Social Security, probably half of the people over 65 would be poor. They would live in poverty. Now, to say that all of a sudden conservatives are coming up with a program to help the poor masks the fact that who really benefits from privatization are the people who can afford to put money into private accounts, who can afford to put money into IRA-style accounts, who would have more money to invest in a private system. If there were no Social Security at all and everybody was free to save on their own, we all know who would do well when they retire, and we all know who would not do well. the people who would not do well would be the people who didn't have money to save. Social Security is a progressive program because it transfers money from the wealthy to the poor. If there's a sliding scale of benefits, people who earn lower amounts of money benefit in greater proportion than the wealthy who, first of all, pay more into the system, but who benefit less when they retire.
Let's talk about some of the companies. Investment Company Institute, ICI. You wrote, lobbying on its behalf, ICI has hired the prominent Washington firm of Verner & Liebfert, which employs former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, former Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen, and Richards, the ex-governor of Texas. Talk a little about these big guns.
Well, Verner & Liebfert is a very prominent blue-chip Democratic Party lobbying firm. They've been hired by the Investment Company Institute, which no one's ever heard of, I'm sure, but it represents the mutual fund industry, the Fidelities of the world, who have hundreds of billions of dollars in their money management funds. They're putting big-time lobbyists, not the three that you mentioned, but other lobbyists in this very large firm, as well as their own in-house lobbyists, as well as the lobbyists for their member companies like Fidelity, pushing for privatization, helping people in the House to corral other members of the House into this public pension
contributing to
caucus,
campaigns right now,
putting many millions of dollars into campaigns, and I think doing quite well and essentially being successful so far in convincing a lot of people to move in this direction.
Michael Tanner, whatever you think about the issue, how are we going to get accurate information when you've got the entire mutual fund industry with its a huge amount of money pouring money into studies and this big push for privatization? How can anyone trust that what it's saying is actually going to help people like us?
Anyone who believes that the Cato Institute can be bought doesn't know the Cato Institute. We've had more donors walk away from us because of the integrity of our stance than probably any think tank in Washington. We've unequaled anybody.
Who has walked away from you?
Bill Simon walked away because of our opposition to the Gulf War. We've had companies walk away because of our opposition to sugar subsidies and other forms of corporate welfare. We have always taken a position based on principle, never on who our donors are. But beyond that, I agree, Wall Street will make money off of this. There's no doubt about it. But so will that poor individual. You take a minimum wage worker and let them invest money in.
How do you invest if you're minimum wage?
The money is deducted from their paycheck the same way it is now, but instead of being directed to the government, it's directed to the money manager of their choice and then invested in the private sector.
Riskier.
Less risky than politics. In fact, if you look at 1977 when we changed the benefit formula, created the Notch babies, the people on Social Security lost more in future income from that political change than they would have if they'd invested at the worst point of the stock market crash.
Well, it is a very risky scheme, as a matter of fact, because the stock market, which is on a 9-year boom right now, could go on a 9-year bust starting tomorrow, and I think proponents would have a lot more difficult time convincing people to privatize. In addition, we're talking about creating tremendous transition costs. For every dollar that you divert into private accounts today, you're taking a dollar out of the Social Security system, which is paying current retirees. So basically, you're going to have to either increase taxes dramatically to cover that transition, or you're going to have to do extremely hard cuts in budget that would be more dramatic than you could imagine to pay for this transition costs.
Well, for all that this means to so many people in this country, there's almost no discussion of it right now. You always hear Social Security, but at what actually it means. And you were writing, Bob Dreyfus, that President Clinton has kept a report prepared by the Social Security Advisory Council bottled up for months, and it's not expected to be released until after the election. And of course, that is one that is going to start talking about privatization. Last comments.
Yeah, I think the reason it hasn't come up in the campaign is because, in part, the Democrats know that if the Republicans were to bring it up, Clinton would have to attack it, and that would lock Clinton into opposing it. I don't think they particularly want to oppose it next year. And Dole knows that it's a complete loser of an issue. If he were to bring it up, he would get clobbered. So I think both parties have agreed just not to talk about it.
We find that this has broad support across ideological and political lines. Young people, regardless of whether they're liberal or conservative, regardless of whether Democrat or Republican, support privatization. This is an issue for the future.
Well, we want to thank you both for joining us, and we'll certainly continue to follow the story of Social Security, which is going to hit the headlines after this election. Bob Dreyfus of Mother Jones Magazine and Michael Tanner of the Cato Institute, thanks for being with us. And you're listening to Democracy Now! By the way, we'd love to get your comments on this issue, folks. You can call us on our comment line. We're going to be playing comments right through the election on how you feel about a lot of issues. First of all, who you're going to be voting for president, if you're going to be voting at all, and why, how you feel about Social Security and issues like Medicare. So do give us a call on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999. Extension 313. Well, talking about money, during the last presidential debate, President Clinton boasted that there was less than 1% difference in the defense budget he proposed and the one advocated by Republicans. Defense has clearly been kept off the table in this presidential election year, and our next guest, William Hartung, thinks he knows why. Arms manufacturers have been pouring money into the 1996 campaigns to protect their contracts here in this country and to protect their sales of weapons abroad. Bill Hartung is with the World Policy Institute, based in New York City at the New School for Social Research, which has just released a report on arms exporters and political contributions. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bill.
Good to be here.
Well, why don't you tell us your major findings in this expose that you've just done?
Well, I found out that the arms manufacturers have a love affair with the 104th Congress, and for good reason. The last 2 years running, they've gotten billions of dollars in additional weapons spending, more than the Pentagon even asked for. They got a $7 billion increase last year, a $9 billion increase this year. They also got $600 million in additional subsidies for arms exports, up to $7.6 billion. They got a new arms export loan guarantee fund that can spend up to $15 billion that'll have to be guaranteed by taxpayers. They got tax breaks for foreign dictators who want to buy U.S. weapons. So basically, to keep things going, to keep the status quo going, to keep the goodies coming to the industry, they've spent $6.5 million on the 1996 elections. And in the Congress, about by a 2-to-1 margin, they've tried to keep Republicans in there. They like Newt Gingrich. They like the Republican way of doing things. But they've also poured substantial money and soft money into the Democratic Party because Bill Clinton, frankly, has been a friend to the industry as well. So they've got a situation where whether Clinton or Dole wins, they'd like to keep a Republican Congress, keep that extra money flowing their way.
And the number one contributor?
Lockheed Martin. They're now the biggest defense contractor in the country. They gave $1.6 million. About one out of every $4 given by arms exporting companies was given by that one firm. And so they're sort of the leader of the packs. You know, they're the firm that everybody looks to set the agenda for the arms industry. They give big donations to Gingrich, to the Texas delegation, because they build F-16s down in Texas, which they'd like to sell to Chile, to Indonesia, all over the world. And so Lockheed Martin and their CEO, Norm Augustine, are kind of the shock troops, the leading force for the military-industrial complex to get what it wants in Washington.
It always strikes me as a great irony, Norm Augustine, the head of Lockheed Martin, also the chair of the board of the American Red Cross, talking about, where it is you need blood to go in different countries. Well, certainly places where there's fighting, and he makes sure that that happens around the world.
Well, he's working both sides of the aisle. He can help kill him, and then he can help patch him up, I guess. You know, it's a full-service operation.
Can you talk about the Texas delegation?
Yeah, there's a guy named Joe Barton, who hardly anybody's heard of. And going back to the 92 elections, he helped get the Bush administration to lift a ban on F-16s to Taiwan, and they sold a $6 billion batch of 150 planes down there. More recently, the Texas delegation has been in a heavy letter-writing campaign to sell Cobra helicopters to Turkey. Turkey has been using those helicopters of similar type to slaughter Kurds, to evacuate Kurdish villages. There's been close to 20,000 Kurds killed in Turkey's war against its Kurdish population in the last 10 years. So Barton has been the top recipient of campaign contributions, not only from Lockheed Martin, which builds the F-16, but also from Textron, which builds the Cobra helicopters. And the Textron has invested $50,000 in that Texas delegation as a whole. So there's a lot of pork barrel politics here, that they get the home state legislators where the systems are built to do their bidding in Washington, and they grease the skids with big campaign money.
Were you surprised by anything you found in this report, Bill Hartung?
Well, I've been studying this for 15 years, so it's hard to be surprised. I think one thing that surprised me was the incredible enthusiasm that the industry has for Newt Gingrich. As Speaker of the House, he doesn't make the direct decisions about how much is spent on weapons or which programs get through, but he's worked behind the scenes. He's put in sympathetic committee chairs. He's spoken favorably for things like the F-22 stealth fighter, which Lockheed Martin builds just outside his district. He got over $50,000 from arms manufacturers, far more than Dick Gephardt got. And Gephardt was sort of the speaker for McDonnell Douglas. McDonnell Douglas is right near his district in Missouri. He's always gone to bat for them. Gingrich, because he's got so many different special interests that he's been helping out, his role in helping Lockheed Martin, helping the military industry, has been somewhat obscured in the other, because of the many of the other companies that he's gone to bat for.
What about Richard Gephardt?
Well, Gephardt, his service to McDonnell Douglas most recently was to help them secure a big deal for F-15s to Saudi Arabia. He helped convince President Clinton to sign off on that deal. He helped get liberals in Congress to back off from blocking it. That was a $9 billion deal, and McDonnell Douglas to this day is still making money off that deal, which happened 4 years ago. So he really has been sort of McDonnell Douglas's point man in Washington. Gingrich now is doing the same kind of thing for Lockheed Martin.
The top recipients of arms exporter PAC funds in the Senate?
Well, the Senate is very heavy towards Republicans, people like John Warner, people like Ted Stevens from Alaska, people like Fred Thompson, that actor from Tennessee who often does the Republican responses. On down the list, Pete Domenici, the budget chairman, Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, who was the lead man in trying to kill the code of conduct bill in the Senate, which would have made it harder to send arms to dictators. You have to go pretty far down the list to find a Democrat in the Senate. Down around number 10 or 11 is Carl Levin from Michigan, who often works for General Dynamics on its sales of tanks overseas. So there's really kind of they're betting on keeping this Republican gravy train going, because although Clinton's been good to them, the Republicans have been even better. They've added $7 to $9 billion a year on top of what the Clinton Pentagon has been asking for. And the ideal world for the Republicans probably would be a pro-export president like Clinton and a right-wing Republican-controlled Congress.
You know, something that people don't usually understand, I think, is the issue of corporate welfare around arms contractors, that we're not just talking about arms contractors selling their weapons abroad, but the U.S. government pushing those sales abroad, not to mention all of the breaks that it gives the industry.
The Clinton administration has basically made its cabinet sort of a sales team for the arms industry, going back to the late Ron Brown as Commerce Secretary. Look at Warren Christopher, Secretary of State, Bill Perry, Secretary of Defense. Even President Clinton himself has lobbied for arms sales when he meets with foreign leaders in the White House. He met with the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, tried to get him to buy Apache helicopters from McDonnell Douglas during a meeting that was supposed to be about the future of Bosnia. So they've basically said, you know, we're going to be there for you. We're going to help you close the deal and make these sales. And then they've made loans, grants. They've lent out aircraft at taxpayer expense to do demonstrations at foreign air shows in places like Chile, Indonesia, United Arab Emirates. So the Clinton administration really, their motto is sort of, we're there to help the arms industry sell its goods around the world. And even more so than the Bush or Reagan administrations, they've had this infectious enthusiasm for promoting arms sales. And they've backed it up with our money, money that's being taken away from welfare for individuals is being given to welfare for weapons exporters.
Right now, President Clinton is pushing the sale of at least 9 F-16s to Indonesia. We'll see if that changes. They're still pretty adamant about it, even with all of the revelations coming out around Indogate, the Indonesian money pouring into the Democratic National Committee. Were you surprised by anything you found, William Hartung, in your report? I mean, this is what you do all the time. This is your work, is looking at the arms industry and its power over Congress and then the administration.
Well, I think one thing that interested me is the impact on votes. I looked at a number of votes, votes in favor of things like an arms export loan guarantee fund, votes to stop things like the code of conduct, which would make it harder to send arms to dictators. And in the code of conduct case in the Senate, the 65 members who voted to block that initiative, which industry was desperately trying to block, got an average of $17,000 each from industry. The 35 who voted against got an average of about $2,000 each from industry. So there was an 8-to-1 margin of cash going to the people who helped industry block that important initiative. And furthermore, people who didn't get any industry money actually voted for arms control, for human rights, for the code of conduct. Hmm. People who got industry money voted overwhelmingly with the industry. So I think, if anything, there was a closer tie between campaign money and actually buying votes, that then I would have even imagine myself.
This code of conduct, which would make the administration more responsible and try to stop them from selling weapons to dictators, was sponsored by Mark Hatfield, who's now retired, the Oregon senator, and Cynthia McKinney, the Democrat from Georgia. What's going to happen right now? Cynthia McKinney in a very tight race in Georgia, Hatfield gone.
McKinney's in a tight race. Hatfield's retiring. Byron Dorgan from North Dakota will be the new leader in the Senate. McKinney has generated tremendous enthusiasm on the House side, so there are other people who can take up that battle. But we're hoping that she's going to pull out her election. She's one of the most dynamic members of the House. She is not one to shrink in the face of pressure. She actually, when she was in the Georgia legislature, was censured for coming out against the Gulf War at the height of the yellow ribbon fever. We need advocates like her. There's very few members of Congress with her integrity, her enthusiasm, her dynamism, not only on civil rights issues, domestic issues, but also on stopping arms getting into the hands of dictators. So that's going to be a very crucial race. But I hate to say it, but if by any chance she doesn't win that race, we're going to have to find other advocates of equal energy, and people are going to have to push hard for these kind of things, because the industry is certainly spending its money, using its clout. We need to counter that with unprecedented amount of people power against arming dictators.
Bill Hartung, the phone number if people want to get your report, Peddling Arms, Peddling Influence, Exposing the Arms Export Lobby.
It's 212-229-5808. That's the World Policy Institute at the New School in New York City.
That's 212-229-5808. Thanks very much for joining us, Bill Hartung, who's put out this report on the weapons packs that have contributed to the 96 elections. I want to thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we take a look at the affirmative action debate, Proposition 209 in California. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. During his campaign sweep through California this week, Bob Dole emphasized his support for Proposition 209, the controversial ballot measure that would outlaw affirmative action in the state. Dole used to support affirmative action, but switched his position to attract more voters. The most recent polls show that more than half of Californians plan to vote for the measure. Laura Sapinero has this report on what Proposition 209 might mean for California and the nation.
Affirmative action is essentially preferential treatment for a racial minority or for a gender group.
Affirmative action is about having an equal opportunity to compete.
The term affirmative action was coined by President John F. Kennedy in 1961. 3 years later, President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
We believe that all men are entitled to the blessings of liberty. Yet millions are being deprived of those blessings, not because of their own failures, but because of the color of their skin.
Among other things, the 1964 Civil Rights Act prohibited racial discrimination in federally funded programs and called for the desegregation of public facilities and schools. Today, Californians must decide whether to abolish efforts to diversify public universities and workplaces through programs that target women and ethnic minority applicants. Backed by Governor Pete Wilson, Proposition 209 would amend the California Constitution to outlaw preferential programs based on race and gender.
I think if you create a situation where someone can win a government contract because of the color of their skin, that's discrimination. That's racist. And that's an unfair advantage. And if you're going to level the playing field and have people truly compete on their merits, you almost must remove affirmative action.
I mean, I'm white, so I don't have to deal with color racism. But as a female, I work at UCLA, And, you know, you think it's a public institution, I should make as much money as the male next to me who does the same work, but that's not true. You know, the guy next door who does the same job I do gets paid $2 more an hour than I do. So we certainly don't live in a world that lacks sexism and racism, so it should not be eliminated.
I am a plain old American of European descent, and I have been, discriminated against. I have been replaced on my last job by a person from country halfway around the world that has half my age and accepted the job at half the pay. I think that we should have it open so that everybody can compete fairly on the merits of what they know, what their skills are, regardless of their color or where they came from or sex.
I think we still need a affirmative action because in real life, really, a lot of minorities do not get really too much chances to get a job and be hired. I'm still thinking there's some kind of prejudice still in job hiring because of the race.
No, discrimination exists in society. I would be the last to ever deny that. I mean, I'm discriminated all the time as a Christian.
Reverend Lou Sheldon is executive director of the Traditional Values Coalition, located in Anaheim, California.
It is time to revisit the issue of discrimination and see if the method that we are using is boomeranging on us, coming back and hitting us in the face.
Proponents of Proposition 209 believe that 30 years after their inception, affirmative action programs have evolved into an unjust system of reverse discrimination. Opponents of 209 point to statistics. In an average year, about 5% of state contracts in California go to minority-owned business enterprises. 30% of African-American families in California earn less than $15,000 per year. The unemployment rate among Hispanics is twice that of whites. Professor Eugene Volokh of UCLA's School of Law is a strong supporter of Prop 209, known to proponents as the California Civil Rights Initiative, or CCRI.
Why do I support the California Civil Rights Initiative? Because race and sex preferences are wrong. They're morally wrong, whether they favor whites or males or females or blacks or Hispanics or Asians or American Indians or anybody. Race and sex preferences are wrong. And that, I think, is the message of the Civil Rights Act. That's the message of the Constitution. And that has been, I think, the great message of the Civil Rights Movement. Every year, UC Berkeley, 300 to 500 students who would have been admitted under a race-neutral system are turned away solely because of their race. These are not people who are just denied offers of admission. These are people who would have gone to the school if it weren't for the fact that they had the wrong color skin.
According to a 1995 report by the UC Admissions Task Force, the elimination of race and ethnic criteria from the admissions process will result in a 30% decrease in the number of African American, American Indian, and Latino admits. As one of two alumni regents, Richard Russell Jr. represents the 850,000 alumni of the University of California system at meetings of the UC Board of Regents. Now a partner at the law firm of Overlander, Lewis & Russell in Pasadena, Russell believes affirmative action programs helped him gain access to the field of financial law, an area with very few African American practitioners. I asked Russell to comment on the admissions process at UC.
The greatest focus is grades and test scores. The University of California campuses have also taken into consideration, for example, where you come from in terms of geographics. We've decided to give a preference to those students who come from rural areas at Berkeley. Now, what that means is that's a plus. That accident of birth, the fact that you live in some rural area, counts as a plus. In fact, for fall 1995, we had more students admitted to Berkeley that actually showed up to classes who were entitled to rural preference than those underrepresented minorities. What the regents have said is that any other preference is okay except for race or gender.
Russell commented on last year's decision by the UC Regents to eliminate affirmative action programs at California campuses.
The Board of Regents of the University of California has sent a message that hostile in tone that you know, we don't want those underrepresented minorities. Fortunately, that's not a message that emanates from the entire University of California. It does emanate from a majority of the Board of Regents, but that certainly is not the feeling of the chancellors or the faculty or the staff. Again, much of this has to do with this is the, you know, this for 1996 is the great divisive issue, and there's a hope that one of the parties can ride this divisive issue to victory.
Last year, 10 bills identical to Proposition 209 were introduced in the California legislature. Each was defeated. In 1995, the CCRI campaign began collecting signatures to put the issue to a vote on the November ballot. The California Republican Party contributed $156,000 to the signature campaign. Gene Morrison is director of the Speaker's Bureau of the Campaign to Defeat 209. I asked Morrison about the funding sources behind her opponents.
Monies are coming in from state contractors, general state contractors who stand to gain if they no longer have to make a good faith effort to reach out to include women and people of color, at least in the requests for bid process. Money is also coming in from the Republican Party through sources like funders that normally fund GOPAC. In addition to that, some fundamentalist thinkers, you know, like the two writers of the initiative, Tom Wood and Glenn Custrid, are both associated with a group called the National Association of Scholars. This group is on record as opposing affirmative action, wanting to eliminate women's and minority ethnic studies programs and resource centers, and is opposed to current sexual harassment policies, all of which would be potentially affected by Proposition 209.
Thomas Wood is one of the official authors of 209. Wood serves as executive director of the California affiliate of the National Association of Scholars. During an assembly judiciary hearing held September 24th, Wood stated that the proposition was written to include the elimination of minority outreach and recruitment programs. He also said that most magnet schools would be prohibited. The National Association of Scholars has worked to abolish affirmative action in faculty hiring and student admissions in many states. NAS receives financial backing from the Olin, Bradley, and Smith-Richardson Foundations. These three foundations also fund two of the country's leading conservative policy groups, the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute. Alberta Christie is Secretary Emeritus of the Orange County Republican Party.
Over the years, you have seen where liberal factions have come in and taken over as far as now setting up what we would call quotas. In other words, you're now demanded that you have so many of a certain ethnic race, whether they're qualified or not.
There haven't been legal quotas with regard to affirmative action programs since 1976, and yet our opponents have insisted that quotas remain a part of affirmative action. It's really my opinion that a lot of the misinformation that's out there is really amounts to race baiting, an attempt to use affirmative action as a wedge issue to propel Republicans into office.
Patty DeDominick is president of PDQ Personnel Services and former president of the National Association of Women Business Owners.
Let me tell you that, in fact, in government contracting, while there are almost 8 million women business owners in the United States now owning almost 50% of all the small businesses in this country, do you know that women-owned businesses get less than 2% of all government contracts?
Mary Louise Serafin is an attorney with the law firm of Chadbourne and Park, located near downtown Los Angeles. She spoke in support of 209 at a debate sponsored by the Japanese American Citizens League, held in Gardena.
No one is in control of their race or their gender, and we don't want to have a culture where people are evaluated on those kinds of characteristics.
Abby Liebman is executive director of the nonprofit California Women's Law Center, located in the Mid-Wilshire District.
affirmative action has served women and girls of all colors in an extraordinary way in this state. We take for granted some of these efforts without thinking that they too are jeopardized by this kind of initiative. So, for example, in Los Angeles, where we had terrible problems with our police department, and one of the things that became clear in the research and investigations that followed a lot of allegations of brutality was that women on the force were much less likely to use excessive force. And we leveraged that into an effort to increase the recruitment of women into the police force. And those women that are recruited to become part of the LAPD are highly qualified. They meet all of the same requirements that the men do, and they are less likely to use excessive force. Those efforts are affirmative action efforts. Outreach to women in particular, targeted outreach, that is an affirmative action effort.
Under a court mandate, the Los Angeles Police Department increased its percentage of female officers from 2% in 1981 to 14% in 1993. Erwin Shemerinsky is a professor of law at the University of Southern California.
It is likely that a wide array of different programs will be abolished by Prop 209. For example, colleges and universities that engage in outreach to encourage more minorities and women to apply likely won't be able to do that. Programs to encourage girls to take advanced science and math will be eliminated, because all of these can be seen by some court, some government agency, as a form of preference.
Hey, my name is Judy Posnack. I live in Cypress, California. I'm a psychotherapist in private practice in Los Alamitos, California. I come from a bit of a bias here. My former position was with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. I was a deputy sheriff and a sergeant, and had to take an early retirement due to an injury. And when I went on this department, there was no affirmative action. And I believe people can do whatever they set out to do. I did it. I didn't have help. I managed to go up in rank and all of that without any special privileges. And I did it just because I worked very, very, very hard. And I think it's time to get back to the work ethic that made my legal immigrant grandparents great and realize their American dream, and it's here for all of us, but not if we keep handing out things.
Pertenezco doblemente a esta acción afirmativa y en realidad nos están quitando bastante.
Juliet Salazar is a student at Glendale Community College, where she studies business administration. Salazar came to the United States from Ecuador 2 years ago.
En mi caso, yo he venido acá a estudiar el inglés y a seguir adelante, pero si quitan esto, en realidad están quitando un poquito más de, va a ser un poquito más difícil para nosotros poder.
As a woman and a Latina, I am twice affected by affirmative action programs. It is very painful for me because I feel that the moment they take away affirmative action, they are really taking away a small piece of equality, one that allows us to compete with others.
Reverend Dr. Ignacio Castuera is pastor of North Glendale United Methodist Church and vice president of the Los Angeles Progressive Religious Alliance.
I want to tell you that the whole United States is a third world country from this point of view. That in third world countries, a very small percentage of the population controls a very large portion of the wealth. And in the United States, in the last 10 years, in the last 20 years, the top 1% has doubled its percentage of the national wealth. Obviously, that is undermining the buying power, the economic well-being of a lot of people. Most people are indolent. They are not going to study the reasons why that has happened, and they go after any mermaid song, you know, that says, you know, it's all of those Mexicans that are crossing the border, it's all of those blacks or Hispanics or all those women that were given a job last year and you did not get it. You know, instead of saying, you know, you didn't get the job because there are less jobs today than there have ever been, these people are cleverly tapping into a frustration, you know, which then reinforces the position of those in the top 1%, because nobody's going to keep on looking towards that 1%.
Our report on California's Proposition 209 was produced by Laura Saponera with support from the Liberty Hill Foundation. If you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer Kenneth Mason. Thanks to Errol Maitland in New York. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!